Welcome to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at weepa.org. Here's your host, Mike Causey.
Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and glad to have you with us. And we have a favorite guest today, everybody's favorite, really, Tammy Flanagan. She is probably the world's leading authority on federal benefits and came up the hard way and learned the ropes and is knows it all, does, sees all, knows all, does all, and helps me very often with columns. So, Tammy, thank you for being with us today. The column... We're always looking for different angles, a way to plug the show, a way to plug the column, have a snappy headline, but make it accurate. You know, don't make it the earth is ending and then it's not. But in this case, I recall years ago, there was a General Accounting Office before it was named the Government Accountability Office, General Accounting Office study. And I believe it said at that time that only about less than one third of the people who come to work for the federal government actually retire from it. And it's the kind of thing you don't think of because so many people think of Uncle Sam as the employer for life. And, you know, once you're in, you're fireproof and yada, yada, yada. It turns out it's not the case, never has been. And one of the reasons that they adopted this, quote, new, we say new, it's mid-1980s now. But one reason they replaced the old retirement system with the newer one, FERS, is that FERS has a portability factor, a Social Security thrift savings plan, and you can move from the government to private sector and back and forth. Also, it's cheaper to the government somewhat. But at any rate, that really changed the rules. And at one point, if you were a lifer, if you worked for Uncle Sam for instance, 40 years, seems extreme, or 41 years, but many, many people do it. And those people retire on an annuity based on their highest three-year average salary and over a period of time. And many of them retired with annuities of 80% of their salary. And 60, 70 is not at all uncommon. FERS is a very different breed of cat. And you have to know, civil service retirement system kind of fire and forget. You join it at 18, you leave at 60, boom, you're in good shape. FERS is very different, have to do a lot of planning, which is good for you because you are a planner by trade and you work as a retirement coach and a retirement consultant. But can you sort of go into the differences between SERS and FERS?
Sure, Mike. And first of all, thanks again for having on. And it's good to see you in person
because
we are starting to open up the world again and get together. And it's just so refreshing because I didn't realize how much I miss seeing people until I started coming back out and taking the mask off and getting able.
Well, I apologize for the haircut. My son and I get them at a special barber and we can't get appointments. So
I
look like.
I was going to ask you if you were going
to. I look
GQ
like Curly.
Yeah, no,
Curly
good.
In.
But anyway, so yeah, with retirement, it's. To me, it's fascinating, and I guess that's why I've stuck with it so long, and you've made it interesting for me as well. Mm-hmm. But between civil service and FERS, and as you said, civil service is like that single benefit plan, and I remember one time, a long time ago, you told me that when you'd meet a federal employee on the subway or in the metro mm-hmm. somewhere, they would always say, you know, I've got 5 years, 3 months, and 2 days left.
Yeah.
Because civil service, usually when you came on board, you knew that day when you could retire.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the whole goal of your federal career is to get to retirement, to have
right.
this life of leisure mm-hmm. and lifetime health benefits and all of that. And like you said, if you work long enough, you could pretty much replace your net salary
yeah.
with just that pension benefit,
yeah.
just that annuity.
When you lose the deductions and whatnot.
Right,
yeah.
right. So it was wonderful. And everyone was skeptical when FERS came on the scene in 1987 and thinking, oh, we don't want nothing to do with that. Whatever's good for the government's probably not good for us. So very few people switched who had the opportunity to change their retirement from SERS to FERS. But of course, all the new hires didn't have a choice and they went under this system. And I think throughout their careers, they probably felt inferior because all of their CSRS coworkers were telling them how unfortunate they were
yeah.
to be under FERS. But guess who had the last laugh? Our FERS employees now have an incredible amount in their TSP accounts as a whole, especially
yeah.
those getting closer to retirement who've been contributing for 20 or 30 years. I mean, I think they've amazed themselves at how quickly that account has accumulated. And this wonderful stock market we've had for the last 10 years has not hurt those balances. So the FERS system has also worked out very well. And as you said, one of the main focuses of FERS was to accumulate or to accommodate Social Security coverage, because we had a change in a law back in 83 that said all federal employees had to pay into Social Security. So Congress had to design a system. But like you said, Senator Stevens came up with this more portable nature, because we have federal employees who come into government service after a career in the military where they just got done paying Social Security tax for 20 years. So we don't want to put them under a system where they're exempt from Social Security. And also we have this idea today that was different in the past, where employees feel stagnant if they stay in the same job for 5 years, where we thought, hey, that's seniority. Yep. We're going to move up the career ladder. So it's a different mentality of how a career should progress today than it was before. And that sometimes means that federal employees don't remain federal employees until retirement. So we needed that portability and flexibility of being able to move our TSP account to a private sector 401k, or moving our Social Security coverage throughout our career just kind of follows us. So the only part of FERS that's really unique to federal service is the government pension. And I know we like to call it a FERS annuity. And that benefit, even though it is kind of unique, it's portable as well, because you only need 5 years of service to be vested, to have some ownership of a benefit. And once you hit 10 years of service, then you can collect a benefit as early as your minimum retirement age, which for a lot of our younger employees is 57. Somebody my age, it would be 56, but it's getting closer to 57 for most current employees. So, you know, 10 years of service isn't that long of a commitment to have this pension benefit to reflect your service.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how as you're pointing out, how the people have changed. And you know, job security is no longer a big deal for many. You know, in fact, if you're in a job for more than 3 years, they think there's something wrong with you. But and that's changed in the government, and it's changed in the public mindset. But there are good news and bad news about working under the FERS system. And the one thing to mention is it doesn't. There's nothing you can do about it.
It
is what it is. Everybody coming into the government now is under FERS. 98% of the people who currently work for the federal government, if not 99, are under FERS. So it's here to stay. It's the system. So you have to learn how to use it. And whereas, as you said, in CSRS, you could sign up at age 18, retire at 60, do nothing, hopefully contribute to your thrift savings plan, your 401k. But it was really automatic pilot. And FERS requires some thought and some planning at different stages of the game.
At all stages of the game. Yeah. I like to see some agencies, not many, because of probably budget reasons, they have new employee retirement seminars. You know, who would think a 22-year-old needs to go to a retirement planning seminar? But that's the ideal time to come to learn how to manage money for retirement. You know, we all have TSP accounts if you work for the government. So you have to really understand, you know, what volatility is, what managing an investment is, understanding risk of inflation, understanding risk of, you know, market and so forth. So I think every age of every stage of a career, I think even beginning in high school, don't you think employees should learn about, or students should learn about financial planning, so that they can understand what it means to save for retirement versus save for a new car?
I remember a cartoon when I was a teenager, and it showed a teenager getting his first paycheck, and he looked at, opens the envelope and says, FICA.
Who's FICA? Who's the FICA guy? Who's taking my money?
Yeah, that's very true. And the other, to your point, too, about having new employees take these courses, it would seem to me that would be not a recruiting gimmick, but a retention gimmick.
Yeah.
If I'm 21 years old or whatnot, and I realize there is this retirement ahead of me, the better I do, the better I do in retirement, the potential for the thrift savings plan, the sick leave program, the annual leave, the fact that you can accumulate leave, whereas many private employers don't allow that. I think that would be a big factor in maybe keeping some of the best and brightest.
Yeah, and the other thing I'll notice with some employees or at some agencies, they do a total compensation report. And they provide that to the employees. So it shows them not only their paycheck, but the value of their benefits, how much the government contributes to FERS, how much the government contributes to their health insurance and life insurance. And I think when you see that whole picture, it's like, wow, maybe my salary is $85,000, but the value of my benefit package is well over $200,000.
Yeah, okay.
And so when you're moving away, you have to consider all of that.
All right, Andrew Mitchell wants us to take a break here, and what Andrew wants, Andrew gets. So we'll take a break here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. Be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tammy Flanagan, benefits expert. Tammy, before the show, we were talking. You and I have known each other, what, 30 years? Could it be?
I think so. But
I remember you started at the FBI, and I think you were a GS-3.
I started at a GS-3. I think it was a GS-9.
Okay.
I was so proud of earning my GS-9.
My mother was a GS-3 at the Pentagon when it was still under construction.
Oh, my.
So this goes
60s,
back a
yeah.
long. So I know the drill, you know, being that. And she was under CSRS and had a very good retirement as a result. But now you started out at the FBI, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting place to begin government.
I enjoyed the time I spent there because I worked, you know, I started off as a clerk, and I think I did some data entry, and then I went to the tour unit, and from that led me into personnel. And I started out as a classifier, you know, somebody who takes a job description and tries to fit it to the grade level of the employee.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't enjoy that work. It felt thankless, and it was difficult because you really had to study this position, interview the employee, and the boss, of course, wanted the pay raise for their employee,
uh-huh.
and it wasn't always granted. So I didn't like the work as much. It was good work, but didn't like it. So I looked around and tried to find another position. I saw an opening in the retirement. We had a retirement office
mm-hmm.
at the FBI, and that's all the people did there was review retirement claims, help people retire. And I thought, well, that'll be a thankful job because, you know, people love to retire. And it was. And I went in there, and there was only three of us. And we did all the retirements for the Bureau. We had 25,000 employees, and I just loved it. But FERS came along, and I started a family. And I decided to go part-time, and it was getting busy with FERS. So the boss said, you have to go full-time. And I made a decision to leave the government because I wanted to spend more time at
mm-hmm.
home. But perfect timing, because that's when retirement seminars and retirement planning
oh, yeah.
became popular. So I had an opportunity to do training. And boy, the stage fright almost did me in. But I got over it. Thank goodness I did, because I then became really enjoying that work. So retirement planning
well,
has always been a
passion. I remember those seminars in the government. I guess they do them by Zoom now, but I remember attending a lot of them. And they talk about the wisdom of the crowd. It's absolutely true. I may go in with a spouse or what have you, but somebody will ask a question that never occurred to me.
Mm-hmm.
It literally is the wisdom of the crowd.
Yep. I always encourage questions because, like you said, there's something that I may have forgotten to say and they want to know. And usually it pertains to a lot of people in the group.
Well, so I know working for the FBI gave you an expertise, too, in the way the retirement system applies to people, air traffic controllers, federal law enforcement, people like that who are forced to retire early.
Yeah, mandatory separation. So that helps a lot to understand both sides of the pension system because it's a little different when someone's retiring at age 50, where they might have another career ahead of them versus somebody who's retiring to go golfing or travel
yeah.
or spend time with family.
And your husband was Secret Service, too.
He was,
so
yeah. So I was married to law
all
enforcement.
Of you. Yeah. Hey, we've got a question here from Tara. I hope I'm saying that correctly. T-E-R-R-A. Says, just saw the article for today's show. Kind of a common question, but for whatever reason, I have a hard time understanding my retirement options. So here's a question scenario that I'd be curious to know the answer to. I am a 44-year-old, recent GS-13 with about 10 and a half years of federal service. What are my retirement options if I don't want to spend the next 10 to 15 years with the federal government? As a side note, I see in your program where you can share a job with another employee and go part-time, but the increased cost in health care does not make that a financially feasible option as a single person. Tara, do not be embarrassed. I don't understand a word of this, but I'm looking at somebody who does.
Yeah, I was going to just say that's an excellent question
yeah.
because I'm sure it's on the mind of a lot of people these days because, I don't know, this new word we now know is pivot. You know, we had to pivot with
yeah.
the pandemic and do different things and do our work differently. And I think it caused a lot of people to pause and think about what do we really want for the next 10 years, next 20 or 30 years. I even for myself, I learned how to work more from home, which means I don't have to travel as much. And I think I can make that work for the future. So I know everyone's got this on their mind as far as how is this changing the way we do business? How is it changing the way we work? So for Tara, I think it's great. You know, she's already has more than 10 years of service. Stepping backwards, once you have 5 years, and I said before that you're vested, what that means is that with as little as 5 years of service, if you leave federal service, you want to move into the private sector, become self-employed, you can still collect a small pension. It's worth 5% of your high three because every year of service is worth 1% under FERS. So if she had 5 years, it would be 5% with 10 and a half years. If she left tomorrow, her retirement waiting for her would be 10.5% of her average salary over the last 3 years. Now, when she gets to claim that benefit is at two different points. She could either collect it reduced when she reaches 57, which would be her minimum retirement age, or she could claim it when she's 62 and not have to suffer an age reduction. Because the age reduction that she'd take is pretty severe. It's 5% per year that she'd be under 62 at the time she claimed it. So at 57, that would be a 25% reduction in that 10.5% benefit. So it wouldn't be a lot of money, but it's something to show for what she did. And the other part of that, like we said, FERS is a three-tiered system. So in 10.5 years, she's probably accumulated quite a bit of money in her TSP account. That's all hers. That's immediately vested. The only thing that a federal employee has to wait to own is that 1% agency contribution, and even that's vested after 3 years. So all of her TSP money belongs to her. She can leave it in the thrift. She can move it to a new employer plan or to an IRA. And, of course, her Social Security benefits, they're the same working for the government, whether she works for private industry or works for fast food in high school. Right. It's all the same Social Security system. So, you know, she has a lot already started towards her retirement. I think what she needs to really think hard about if she's going to leave federal service is that she's only 13 years. At 44 years old, she's only 13 years from an immediate retirement. So if she can just double her service by a little bit and stay until 57, then she locks in lifetime health insurance and life insurance and all of the insurance benefits that you have as a federal employee. Those would carry with her. But if she leaves now, that's a resignation with no entitlement to immediate benefits, which means she wouldn't get to keep her health and life insurance.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you, because that's such an important perk in the federal government. Average federal employee and retiree can choose from 20 to 30 plans. In the Washington area, I think it's 35. Yep. And you can't be turned down for any reason. If you hit your catastrophic limit, you can move to another plan. And it's wonderful. And the government pays 72-75%. So that's what I was talking about earlier about the value of going to these retirement seminars. Is somebody might think, well, I'll work now, retire, I won't get a health benefits, but it'll be worth it. It's not going to be worth it. It can be very dangerous. The other thing in this is the magic number in FERS is 62.
Yeah.
What do we mean by that?
Yeah, I always thought that maybe Congress secretly wanted everyone to work till they were 62 because they built some things into FERS that really create an incentive to stay until that age, especially if you're close. Like if you're going to go at 61, take a look at 62 because you might find a nice bump in your retirement. You'll qualify for cost of living adjustments starting at age 62 in most cases. So there's a few things there. When I talk about a bump in the benefit, for FERS, as I mentioned before, the benefits computed at, it's a pretty simple formula, 1% times your salary, your high three average, times your length of service. So 1% is easy to multiply by. But Congress said when you turn 62, if you have 20 years of service, and that can include sick leaves, it could be 19 and a half years of service, 6 months of sick leave, gives you 20 years. Now we're going to compute and multiply by 1.1%.
Big deal.
Yeah, and a lot of people, it's only 0.1. That's 10% increase. That's a pretty big deal in terms of, you know, if your high three is 80,000, 100,000, 170,000, you're adding quite a bit onto that benefit just by staying. And it's amazing how many people I've talked to about that who weren't really aware. They knew about it, but they didn't really run the numbers. And once they did, I think I talked a few people into sticking around a few more years just to hit that milestone.
Yeah. Well, it's always interesting, too. One time, years after he had himself retired from the federal government, I talked to a guy who had been head of the entire retirement program for everybody over the years. Super honorable man, World War II vet, greatest guy in the world, kind of public servant you wish was in every job. And he said, with a little mischievous smile, he said there, to his knowledge, there had never been a major piece of retirement legislation impacting federal workers that did not benefit some individual member of Congress or family member or somebody on the staff. And he pointed this out. So when you say, when we're questioning why age 62 is the magic reason, I'll bet there's a reason
there's
for it.
There's probably somebody another ulterior reason. You know? That's right. Somebody said, hey.
Yeah. So we've got another question here, and says, "Oh, this is good because you talk to probably a lot more federal workers than I do, you know, on the phone and face to face. Has the pandemic forever changed the mindset of the American worker, in which they're insisting in a work-life balanced approach and are willing to quit their jobs in order to achieve their goals? Do employers now have to be more flexible?" And obviously, in this case, we're talking about, does Uncle Sam as an employer? And that's really a heavy question. Nobody has the answer, obviously, but that's a big deal.
It is. And before I came up here to Washington this week, because this is my first time to really teach in front of a live audience and be here in the studio with you, I was thinking the same thing. I thought, you know, do I really want to go back to classroom teaching after I've kind of settled into this COVID life at home in front of my computer? And is the world really going to return to normal? But the funny thing was, the agency I taught at yesterday, they were able to have a live class and a classroom of 75 people. And boy, was that refreshing to be in front of that live audience and to really talk to people face to face. And I think we're going to, I don't know, my prediction is we're going to quickly forget COVID once it's over and done with, and we're going to all return to normal. And so I feel like someone who's going to make a drastic decision based on what's happening at the moment maybe wants to step back and really look at the bigger picture to say, what's life going to be like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, if I do that and leave the government versus what if I just hang around, see how this all washes out? You know, is it going to be really horrible to go back to the office? I did it for the last 20 years. I only had this break for a year.
That's an interesting take.
Yeah. And then other people, you know, who are eligible to retire, they might go ahead and pull the plug and retire because they did get a taste of what it's like to be home all the time. And some people like that.
Okay. Andrew wants us to take a break here, and we'll be right back on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan. Tammy's a benefits expert and is now in private practice, if that's the correct term. How do people get in touch with you?
Well, I have a website. It's called retirefederal.com. So I try to keep it pretty simple. Or they can email me at Tammy, T-A-M-M-Y, at retirefederal.com.
Okay. All right. Very good. And we were talking before about the effect of COVID on the future and the future of work life. And so many people, it's fashionable now to predict that we're all going to be working from home. You know, with spaceships will take us here and there and whatnot. But you make a good point. And I know a lobbyist, and she's always cautioning people. She says, don't worry or make serious plans about what might happen. Deal with what is more likely to happen. And everybody now, nearly everybody, is saying that the wave of the future, people will be working from home or remote sites. And there's already a debate in government as to whether someone who maybe works for the Internal Revenue Service in Manhattan, you know, high wage area, could move to Plano, Texas, a much lower cost area, and continue to get a New York salary. You know, the dimensions there. And some people are saying, yeah, it'd be fair. Others, it'll never happen. And it's fashionable to talk that way. But as you said, maybe people ought to take a breath.
Yeah, I think there has been telework for a number of years. In fact, OPM had a telework web page on this. And I thought it was just recently for the pandemic. And I looked, it had predated the pandemic by a number of years. And I think this whole situation where we've been forced into teleworking and we've been forced to allow our employees to work from home from a management point of view, For some agencies, perhaps it showed them that this can work and that there's still productivity and everything goes on business as usual. Maybe for others, like offices like Social Security offices, you know, we got to really rethink, do we really want everyone to continue teleworking and not be able to sit down with a Social Security representative and go back into our local offices? So I think it's going to be different for different agencies, just like it always has been. But maybe perhaps this will make some agencies a little more flexible, a little bit more willing to let their employees have that flexibility, I would hope. But on the other hand, I think some employees are going to say, you know what, this was great working from home. If my agency won't let me do it, I'll go work somewhere else or I'll become self-employed. And we have so many opportunities. I don't know how people make money on Instagram and Facebook, but I know people who can make a living that way. So there's so many things we can do today with technology that, you know, we just didn't have years ago. So I do think everyone who's been affected by this is stopping to think, where do I want my future to lead? I wonder, and I think it's going to happen. I don't know for sure, of course, but I think a lot of people who had planned to retire last year probably didn't. There was still quite a number of retirements, not too much lower than normal, but somewhat lower. But I think with that combined with the fact that we had a chance to see what it was kind of like to be at home all the time, maybe we'll cause more end of year retirements this year. So my prediction is it's going to be up quite a bit. I don't know if it's quite that tsunami we've been talking about for years, but I think we are seeing higher numbers already this year by several thousand employees more are retiring this year.
That's really something coming from you because, you know, this retirement tidal wave, the brain drain, speculation is that the government will be populated with very low IQ people. All the good ones would leave. That started in the late 1990s. And it has not materialized. And prominent figures have said, today's the day, this is the year. They've written papers about it and books, and I'm surprised there hasn't been a movie. But it didn't happen. And now for you, and you all along said, I'm not surprised. Now you're saying it could happen.
But I still think there's a couple of things working against that prediction. One is there's possibly going to be a pretty decent pay increase for federal employees come January. And even in my class yesterday, students were asking, well, how long do I have to work at that new salary to make that part of my high three? So some people might say, maybe it's worth, you know, if we get a 3% or a 3.5% pay increase, which I don't know for sure will happen. Nobody does. But if that happens, will that have enough impact on my high three to make it worth it for me to stay another year, potentially another 3 years? But we know what happens there is that, you know, I got a pay raise. I'm going to stay 3 years.
Yeah.
Oh, and then I get another pay raise, and before you know it, I have 60 years of service. So that could be a dangerous thing to start thinking about. But you know, we have the retiree COLA coming up that also is making people think, boy, if I was retired, I could be getting a decent COLA this year. But that's something you can't really plan on because it's too late by the time you know it's coming.
Yeah, you can't. I remember people used to say, well, I'm going to retire December 31st, and I'll get some of the pay raise in my last check, and I'll get the COLA. And you think, doesn't work that way.
No, that's not quite how it works. And then the last thing I was going to say that's kind of influencing whether or not we have a lot of retirements is the stock market.
Yeah.
You know, even throughout the pandemic, we didn't have much of a correction. It's been going gangbusters. You know, anyone in the market right now is probably pretty happy with their balances. So perhaps employees want to ride that out a little bit longer and let their TSP accounts hopefully grow more. But of course, we never know when there's going to be a big correction again or a recession or whatever could happen that could stop that from happening. So I think we still need to plan for the future and stay a little diversified in those investments. But it's an interesting time with everything going on.
It really is. And the more you figure it, the more perplexing it is because, you know, do you stay during a pandemic? And if the COLA is if it's 6%, as some are projecting, the retiree COLA for both federal, military, and Social Security recipients, that would be the biggest in decades.
Yeah.
But the downside of that, and we go back to the magic number 62 again for the first program, is those people don't get any cost of living adjustment. Is that correct?
Most people, yeah. So if you're a law enforcement, firefighter, air traffic controller, where you have to retire at a younger age, those employees, when they retire, get immediate COLAs, whether they're CSRS or FERS.
Because they paid more into the system, correct?
They paid more in, and based on, I guess, the mandatory separation, it just wouldn't be right not to let them get the COLA. Where a regular, for lack of a better word, regular employee who's not in a special provisions position, I guess they have the option that they could just stay until 62, and that's when Congress allows the COLA to start for the FERS system. Now, I know there is a bill in Congress, maybe some people have seen it, that would equalize the COLA between CSRS and FERS. Yeah. But most of us who follow legislation don't put too much stock in bills until they become laws, because you know maybe less than 5% of those bills actually pass into law. So it's nice wishful thinking that we would all get COLAs starting when we retire, but that probably won't happen. I don't know. It could.
Very,
never say never.
Very, very wise lobbyist years ago told me that she, and she'd been doing it for 30 years at the time, and she said, if it's legislation affecting federal employees and particularly federal retirees, the rule of thumb is it takes five sessions of Congress, of the House, that is, that's 10 years to get something positive done. So if they started last week, you know, don't make your retirement plans based on that.
Yeah, and we've followed legislation that's been proposed in every Congress for the last 30 years, and it just never comes to pass.
Hey, we got an interesting question this morning. Actually, it was the first one, and I emailed me back and said we'd ask it, and I didn't bring it with me when we moved down to the studio, but it's from Charlie, and you recall it?
Yeah, I'll paraphrase it because I don't recall all of his language, but the basic question was, he paid his military service deposit, and he's a federal employee, and he's planning to retire, and he was wondering about the high three average, and what is it based on? Can they use his military pay, which apparently his is pretty good, as part of his high three. And it's actually your civilian pay rate that's your high three. So he was assuming that was true. He was just trying to confirm that. So yeah, Charlie, it's going to be your civilian salary that's in effect for the highest 3 years of your career. They have to be three consecutive years. For most employees, it's the final 3 years of your career because your salary goes up over the years. It could be different for someone who may have moved from, let's say, the Washington, D.C. area down to Huntsville, Alabama. Maybe their high three was the last 3 years in the D.C. locality rate. Or if somebody took a downgrade or a demotion, then their high three might have been when they had that higher pay rate. But typically, it's the last 3 years of civilian base pay. That includes locality.
I was interesting. I wondered about those people who were forced to move from the D.C. area in agriculture and interior to Kansas City, and it was a lower wage area, and how they handled that.
Yeah, at least they locked in a high three while they were here, especially if they were close to retirement. They knew what their high three was going to be, but maybe they didn't have enough service, so when they took the move, they just had to finish their career.
Tammy, you're a regular columnist for Government Executive, and you did one recently, and I admired it very much. It made me actually understand the situation. But we were talking earlier about the MRA plus 10, and I cleverly in the intro said the MRA stands for minimum retirement age and 10 stands for 10.
You know.
But can you explain that? Because you had an example of a man at three different ages and what this MRA plus 10 would do to him.
When someone tells me I'm going out under MRA plus 10 because I have my 10 years of service, I'm over 56 or 57 years old, and I always want to make sure that they take a look down the road before they make that leap. And so the article that you're referring to, and we did it with your column a few weeks ago too, so I kind of copied what we did together. But so here you are at MRA plus 10. Let's say you're 59 years old. And you've got 19 years of service. And you're saying, I'm going, I got this wonderful opportunity to go work in the private sector. And you are eligible. You've got more than 10 years. You're 59 years old. You're past your MRA. So you would get 19% of your high three, the old 1% times, high three times length of service. But like I said before, with MRA plus 10, that person at 59 would take close to a 15% reduction in that benefit. So what if I work another year? What difference does a year make? Well, I'll be 60, and at age 60, the service requirement for an unreduced benefit is 20 years. So if that person worked one more year that have 20 years that have not only not a reduction to their retirement, but now they're qualified for an immediate benefit with no reduction and a FERS supplement, which is going to bridge those 2 years from 60 to 62 with this extra money that's included in their FERS check to supplement their pension to take the place of Social Security. So that's typically for 20 years, somewhere $1,000 a month, maybe $1,500, depending on your salary.
That's so, the first supplement?
Yeah.
It's worth that much.
Exactly. So that's one benefit, you know, stay one more year.
Yeah.
Well, then you're already 60. Why not stay two more years and hit age 62? So now forget the supplement. I'm going to get my full social, not my full, but my Social Security benefit based on my lifetime of Social Security coverage. So not only my 22 years of federal service, but the 20 years I worked in the private sector. So I could turn that on at 62 if I wanted to, which is going to be more than the supplement, maybe twice as much as the supplement.
I've got a Social Security question I'd like to ask you, but we need to take a break here.
Sure.
On federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM. Be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan. She is a benefits expert and is now in the private practice of coaching and giving retirement advice to people. And if you've been listening to this show, you know, if you're in the FERS system, which the vast majority of current workers are and will be, you really need some advice. You need some help. And Tammy, how can people reach you again?
You can either go to my website, which is retirefederal.com, or you can email me at Tammy, T-A-M-M-Y, at retirefederal.com.
This one always fascinates me, and I wind up kicking myself because I did not do it. But we were at a seminar one time. I was covering it or something, and you were speaking, and you started talking about the advantages of delaying getting Social Security. And I took notes. I was fascinated. And then I got back to the office, and I said, this can't be right. I mean, I figured I'd garble something. And with numbers, there's a good chance that that'll happen with me. But it turns out it is true. And yet there are people who will argue that they want to take Social Security the first day they're eligible because what if I die?
Yeah. You know,
and I think, well, you're dead.
Yeah.
You know, that's what happens there. But I get what they're talking about. I don't buy it, but I get it. But you're talking about delaying it, and the return is monumental.
It's hard to do because you know you've paid into it for the last, you know, 30, 40 years by the time you're 62. You want to get your money's worth, so to speak, from Social Security. So I understand why people who are retired by the time they're 62 will turn it on right away. And that's fine, you know, because some people need it and you don't have another option other than to take it. So there's nothing wrong with necessarily taking it at 62 as long as you can afford to be retired. But I like to get folks to think about the option of delaying it because, first of all, at age 62, that's not your full Social Security age. Your full retirement age for Social Security is between 65 and 67. And for, like you said, for most of our employees under FERS right now, it's 67.
Yeah.
So you're going to be taking a 30% reduction in your full benefit by taking it at 62. And then beyond that, once you're 67, every year beyond that, that you delay accepting the benefit, it goes up 8% a year. Where else can you get a guaranteed 8% per year investment? So the difference between claiming it at 62 versus claiming it at 70 is about a 76% increase in the benefit you would have received at 62 versus the one you'll get if you wait till 70. So that all sounds great, except for, like you said, what if I die?
Yeah.
Or what's, you know, what everybody wants to know is what is the break even? And I say, what difference does it make what the break even is? I want to make sure I can retire comfortably, have enough money to be financially secure. So the way I approach that when somebody asks me about delaying it, what are my thoughts about delaying it? I'll say, well, you know, it's true that you might die at 72 and you won't get your money's worth. You only collect it for 2 years. But the good news there is you no longer need money. So you're okay for 2 years.
All expenses paid.
You don't know the difference beyond that. My concern more so than dying early is what if I live to be 90? What if I live to be 100? That's not uncommon today. We have 80,000 Americans who are centenarians. And by the time I would be 104, we will have, according to the Census Bureau, 600,000 Americans who are over age 100. We're just on the brink of curing a lot of illnesses that cause people to die at younger ages. And I heard somebody say from one of the MIT retirement or longevity institutes, they said that if we can make it to 2030, there's a likelihood we'll make it to 100.
That's incredible.
So that's why I want people to think about their risk of longevity. That's a risk.
It is.
That's a financial risk.
And one of the things, not to interrupt you, but one of the things we now learn is that we have extended life through a variety of means, but it's not necessarily better. Those last few years are not necessarily better. More time in nursing home, more time under care. So money is, you need it every day of your life and then some.
Yeah.
Plus.
So that takes into account not only the Social Security benefit of delaying claiming it, but also the requirement we must think about long-term care, because that can derail us financially if we should have to pay for someone to come into our home or to move into institutional care. All of that's very expensive. So, you know, we also have to give some thought to what if we need that, because it's a likelihood of it. If we make it to 85, we've probably got a 50-50 chance of needing some long-term care during our lifetime.
Right, and so much of it too, people like me always thought of it as you move into a nursing home and they take care of you. But most of it now, I believe, is being done in-home. Mm-hmm. So someone would come in to take care of you or me, and it can be a relative, but it can't be a relative that lives with you.
That's right.
So it would be a sister down the street or something. But yeah, so it's an iceberg there, and we're only seeing the tip of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the majority of people who have the federal long-term care insurance who have gone into claim, those claims are in home care.
Andrew's given us a 2-minute warning. So yeah, do you kind of sum up about what people need to do to retire or to plan to retire?
Right. Yeah, there's so many things to think about when you're planning retirement. And sometimes it's different for someone who's mid-career who thinks, okay, I've only invested 10 or 20 years in federal service. This is my opportunity to either jump ship and go do something else or stay and become a lifer, as we call it. So for mid-career employees, really do some planning and try to crunch some numbers both ways. Say, what if I leave federal service? What if I stay? How long would I need to stay to ensure I have those lifetime benefits? For someone who's ready to retire this year, get your ducks in a row. Make copies of all the important documents. Fill out your retirement application. Be ready to make that decision. Start planning for that specific date. Make sure you have your health insurance in order. Consider survivor elections. Attend a seminar or a webinar if you have a chance to do so to learn more. You don't know what you don't know.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tammy Flanagan. Thanks, Andrew Mitchell. I hope you all have a very good week. Stay safe, and we'll see you here next Wednesday at 10 a.m.
You've been listening to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at WAEPA.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I am your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Vice Admiral Cutler Dawson. Cutler has had an incredible career serving our country for 35 years in the Navy, where he attained the rank of Vice Admiral. And during his service, he had numerous assignments afloat and ashore, including Commander, Second Fleet, Striking Fleet Atlantic, and in Washington at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, where he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Immediately following his retirement from active duty in 2004, he became the president and CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, the world's largest credit union, where he served for 14 years. Under his leadership, Navy Federal grew from 2 million to 8 million members. Phenomenal. Cutler, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've had a fascinating career across both military and the private sector. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your professional journey?
Well, I started out at the Naval Academy, where I graduated in 1970. And then, as you mentioned, spent 35 years in the Navy with six actual afloat commands. The first one was when I was 27 years old. I didn't know enough to be scared of anything, and it was probably one of the highlights of my career. And then after I retired, after 35 years, I went to work at Navy Federal Credit Union as the CEO, where I spent my next 14 years. I'm currently retired and enjoying life, and it's been a great run for me.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over the years?
My style has been quite consistent. I believe, and I've learned this in the Navy, that you have to go to the deck plates to see what is going on. And you have to learn what your people do and how they do it so you can help them to be better at it and more efficient and more productive. It's something that you need to do all the time. I remember I used to tell folks that you don't want to retreat to your cabin. And what I mean by that is the longer you're in a position, the less you think you have to get out and about. But that should be the opposite. You should get out and about more, because people change, situations change, and you've got to figure out a way to get to them and find out what they're doing and what you can do to help them.
We'll talk a little bit more about your book, but I read it, From Sea to the C-Suite. Fantastic read. You talk about the deck plates in that as well. I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this and read some more detail about going to the deck plates. Cutler, who was the most impactful leader in your life, and what quality did you admire about them?
I had numerous while I was in the Navy, but the quality that I enjoyed the most was the leaders that got to know me as an individual, and that they cared about me, and I could tell that they cared about me. And they were not only my leaders, but they were my mentors. And I remember one particular one, Bill Schiffer, when I had my first assignment at the Pentagon. I would go in to see him with my problem of the day, and I knew that he had numerous problems of his own, but he would stop and he would focus on me, and he would make me feel like I was the most important person in his world. And I tried to do that throughout my career, but really it's about caring for your people.
Cutler, in reading your book, there was a quote you used that you used to inspire those people that work for you. And it really got my attention. And it was, you are the captain of your own ship. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that means and how it was useful to you and the leaders you were developing.
Absolutely. What I mean by captain of your own ship, when you are the captain of a ship, sometimes you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't have anybody to turn to make decisions. You don't have anybody to turn to ask, what should I do now? You have to be the captain of that ship. And I translated that into, let's say, Navy Federal's organization, where I would tell branch managers that I said, you are the captain of the ships of Navy Federal. You're the ones that are facing the members or customers, as others call them, every day. And you have to make decisions without a lot of guidance in some cases and without a lot of time. So be the captain of your own ship. Step up, make decisions, do what you think is right, and you never can go wrong.
I think that is so important. And you have to give your people a little bit of latitude to take some risk as well, because there is risk for them in doing that and risk to your organization.
That's right. And I mentioned that I took command of my first ship with 5 years in the Navy, and I was 27 years old. Well, my boss had 32 years in the Navy, and his guidance to me when I first met him was, Cutler, you do the right thing and I'll back you up all the way. What a wonderful way to spend an assignment with backup and guidance like that.
What great advice. It's clear leadership is a topic you're passionate about. You wrote the book we mentioned before, From Sea to C-Suite. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes, when I was at Navy Federal, I would tell sea stories as parables to get my point across. And folks would tell me, Cutler, we like your stories. It gives us a picture of what you're trying to tell us. Now, what else are they going to say? They work for me, but I took it as a compliment, and it was. And My wife encouraged me to write a book, and I needed a co-author to help me. And I found a lady named Taylor Keelan, who was the perfect co-author. She turned in my stories into wonderful chapters that I'm very proud of.
Where can listeners find a copy?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it on the Naval Institute website. And I might add that any proceeds from the book, Navy Federal uses to give to charity.
Fantastic. Cutler, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your time and your lessons and in leadership and sharing with us your life story. And I've learned a lot both from talking to you today and reading your book. And thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. And I would like to add one thing if I could, Shane. During my assignments in Washington, D.C., I gained the utmost respect for the civilians that work here every day. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, and they have my eternal gratitude. I got to come and go from the Pentagon. They stayed every day and worked in Washington when I got to go out and enjoy being at sea.
Perfect, thank you. Yeah, WAPA serves civilian federal employees, but your comment is well taken because the interaction between the two is continuous, it's nonstop, and it's critical. So the career civil servants, as well as career military, our country would not be where it is today without them.
I totally agree. And I can tell you from the US Navy standpoint, we couldn't operate like we do without them being the backbone of what we do.
Thank you very much for your time today, Cutler, and to everyone listening to Lessons in Leadership podcast. We'll see you next time.